You are listening to the Regent College Podcast.
Hello, everyone. My name is Octavio Fernandez y Mostajo.
And my name is Claire Perini.
And welcome back to the Regent College Podcast.
Friends, today you're in for a treat. You're always in for a treat whenever you click play on the Regent College Podcast. But today we're sort of delving into the world of sort of science and theology, and in particular this Darwinism and kind of how we think about that as Christians, how we think about that as a term, and as a how we think about particulars and universal kind of ideas, and how, and really sort of mostly actually about how history helps us understand different ways of thinking. Our conversation was with Dr. David Livingstone, who's a professor of geography and intellectual history at the Queen's University of Belfast, where he works on the history of geographical ideas and historical geographies of science and religion. He's currently completing an intellectual research of climate reductionism, and it's called The Empire of Climate. So we had a lovely, just beautiful conversation with Dr. Livingstone about all sorts of things to do with history, science, theology. It was a great conversation.
Oh man, David Livingstone, Dr. David Livingstone, blew my freaking mind. What a fascinating man. We talked about what Claire just mentioned about Darwinism in a way that made it so crazy fascinating. I was never so into that type of topic. Man, it blew my mind. And you have to stay until the end when he connects Darwinism and race and stories and how particular it became when people took pieces and parts of Darwinism to support their own racist theories.
Colonialism.
I mean, it was just, this was one of the best we've had. It's good. You just got to listen to the end.
So enjoy our conversation with Dr. David Livingstone. Livingstone, welcome to the Regent College Podcast.
Good, thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. We often joke that kind of what accents are you going to hear in the Regent College Podcast? Between Octavio and I, we like to sort of, sometimes we like to compliment it with a, you know, a nice Northern Irish or, you know, an American one or a Canadian. It's just, we like to mix it up.
That couldn't be better. Couldn't be better.
Thanks so much for being willing to chat with us. And we're gonna talk about something you've spent lots of time thinking and talking about. So it's just going to be the most easy conversation for you, and hopefully interesting for everybody who's listening. So we're going to talk about let's start with Darwinism. So Darwinism, sorry. Let's start with me saying it correctly. Darwinism. There could be a critique that Darwinism is atheism. Is that true? Talk to us about that.
Well, I think that you've jumped right into a really interesting question here, because one of the really difficult things is to actually figure out what does the label Darwinism actually mm-hmm. refer to. Mm-hmm. So right from the word go, we're into a question about definitions.
Yep.
So there was a famous book written in 1874 by the theologian Charles Hodge with that very title, What is Darwinism? Mm-hmm. And as he worked through it, he came to the conclusion, I think I quote him, Darwinism is essentially atheism. Now, when you ask the question, why did he think Darwinism is atheism? You might think he's a theologian. He was reading in detail the first chapters of Genesis, and the Darwinian account of evolutionary transformation doesn't seem to have everything being created in 6 24-hour periods and so on. Therefore, it's atheism. No, it was nothing to do with that. His objection was that he felt that Darwin had left out of his explanations anything that wasn't just purely natural. Mm. So for him, Darwinism was fundamentally naturalism. And if it was naturalism, it was therefore essentially atheism. But there's an interesting problem that he encountered. There was a biologist, a botanist at Harvard, who was a Christian, congregational church leader, taught Sunday school, and he described himself as a Darwinian. Well, how could he describe himself as a Darwinian if Hodge's definition was right And it was simply this, that he felt that he could perfectly well accept a creator God, and yet at the same time accept that there was a long earth history, that species had come and gone through evolutionary change, that natural selection was working, and so on. So in a sense, your question is a battle for the definition of Darwinism.
Yeah, right.
So you go along to Daniel Dennett, well-known philosopher now, and he thinks, yeah, sure, Darwinism just is absolutely nothing but atheism. But there are many others who think that Christianity or theism is not at all incompatible with an evolutionary outlook. So we're right into a question about who owns the definitions.
Right.
Who possesses these? Because to have a control of a definition is to exercise enormous cultural power.
Oh, yeah.
Once you control that definition, you're able to say you're on the right side and you're on the wrong side.
Yeah.
So I don't think there's a clear answer to your question. So as a friend of mine once said, if you can't answer the question, question the question.
Yeah, totally. That's what all professors do, David. This is the thing. It's like, do you know, this is the question you should have asked. That's
exactly.
Often what it is, which is
so
great. It's perfect.
I have answered the question that I would like to answer.
Yes.
So there is no essential definition.
Yeah.
It's one of those concepts, and we might come on this later on, that is a contested definition. And that doesn't mean that it's a bad thing. It means it's a fertile word. But that you always have to say, who's asking the question? What interest do they have at stake? Why are they asking this question? Because they're trying to draw a boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And then the question becomes, who's inside the boundary and who's outside it?
Right.
Yeah. I love it. I love it. And I think that answer even gives peace to a bunch of people that would consider themselves Christians and Darwinians, or and they, you know, have a conflict in their hearts, conflict in their minds. But the way you present it is just like, oh, it's about who defines it. Okay, now I get it. And then there's an issue of you know, the movement departing from its founder. It's super classic, like giving the example of Calvin, right? People say like, not even Calvin was like as a Calvinist as some people are today. Is that the case with Darwin? Like, is Darwinism departed from Darwin himself? How different is Darwinism now than it was when Darwin released his writings?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. The same thing arises with was Newton a Newtonian?
Yeah.
Was Calvin Calvinist and so on? We've been through many of these. So again, it's not really easy to answer, Octavio. So coming around about it in a kind of indirect way might be better. I think first of all, what we've got to get clear is that Darwinism is a cultural label as much as a scientific one.
Mm-hmm.
So that means it's doing cultural work in our society. So if I were to say to a scientist, what do you think Darwinism is? You could get a range of different answers. One might be it's a synonym for evolution. Darwin is an evolutionist. There are transformations. Someone might say it is a theory that populations change solely by the actions of natural selection. So you read some contemporary writers, they'll say, you know, natural selection is the only game in town. It explains everything. It explains not only how animals might have evolved, but it explains why we love our children, why we sing together, why we like music, I mean, whatever. And in other words, it becomes an all-embracing sort of meta-narrative, if I can call it that. Now, the problem with that is, if you were to go along to Charles Darwin would be the first to say that natural selection is not the only game in town. As a matter of fact, he thought that there were many evolutionary mechanisms. Some of them were kin selection. Some of them were to do with what he called correlative variation. We'll not get into that. He at sometimes lapsed into a kind of Lamarckism and so on. And then you get the modern Darwinian movement after the neo-Darwinian synthesis. And it's really a kind of algebra for quantifying different survival rates of different genes and their alleles and so on. So is it still contemporary Darwinism in the sense of looking for adaptation to environment and evolutionary transformation over periods of time, I think it is sort of Darwinian. But if you've got someone with a very narrow definition, I bet Darwin doesn't really fit with those narrow definitions of what Darwinism actually is. So again, it depends how you're using the term Darwinism for now to figure out whether Darwin really was a Darwinian or not. So the answer is, in some ways, yes. In some ways, I don't think so.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so and then I think you're probably going to say, I can't do this either. But let's see. Can you? So I'm asking Claire Perini from the Regent College podcast, asking you, David Livingstone, who knows a lot about this, are you a Darwinist? Would you consider yourself that? And then if that's true, what elements of that definition would you be kind of holding on to? If do you know what I mean? So can is that answerable?
Dr. Livingstone, on the spot.
Let's see.
On the spot. Well, first of all, I have to tell you I'm allergic to isms.
Oh, okay, good to know.
I'm allergic to isms, whether it's Darwinism, Calvinism, even evangelicalism, and so on, because it's very, very hard to get everybody to agree what actually is in those concepts. So I think of them more as family resemblances. That is to say, there are a batch of people who are sort of happy to go under the label, say, evangelical, or happy to go under the label Calvinist, even though they might disagree on many particulars. So if you're saying to me this, are you a Darwinian in the sense that you think that there is no supernatural agency acting in the world? I would have to say, no, I'm not a Darwinian, if that's what you mean by it. If you mean by it, do you think that there has been the evolution of species and a long Earth history, and that there are transformations that have been brought about, at least to some degree, by natural selection? I'd be inclined to say yes. Yeah. I think natural selection is operating in the world. Mm-hmm. I think the world is a lot longer here than 6,000 years. I think the evidence for that is actually overwhelming, and so on. I would add, of course, that so far as the technical details of modern genetics is concerned, I wouldn't know enough to really understand exactly what's happening at that micro level. But as a broad story, I think that a Christian can perfectly well be an evolutionist, thinking indeed that there's a long Earth history and that species have undergone transmutation and transformation and adaptation to their environment over many, many millions of years. I have no difficulty with that. Now, my question to you, Claire, is, does that answer your question?
It does.
Or have I evaded what you were trying to get
no,
here?
No, you're good. No, I think that's good. Because I think...
You're so cheeky.
I think this is what we find often in these conversations. It's so great. Because it's like, well, we can't quite define that. And that's absolutely right. We have to broaden our definitions. But it's like, okay, give me some big, broad brushstrokes. And I can be like, okay, that's sort of what we're talking about here. I'm saying this, but I'm not saying that. So, no, you definitely answered my question. Thank you.
Can I add just a little addendum to that?
Of course.
The addendum to this is that, I mean, I think now that there are other evolutionary mechanisms that are being taken seriously by specialists that some of the what I would call high Darwinians or ultra-Darwinians are unhappy about. Developments of things I really don't know very much about. For example, Evo-Devo is one of them, as it's called. There's another whole tradition of epigenetics, which stresses things that are quite different from adaptation to environment and natural selection and so on. And I would want to be pretty ecumenical about saying, you know, this is a complicated world. There are probably many mechanisms at work here. I do resist is thinking this, that everything about us can be explained solely in terms of natural selection. I'm deeply unhappy about that view. Mm-hmm. That doesn't mean to say that I think natural selection is a bad theory of what it's a theory of. But let's be clear what it is a theory of. Mm-hmm. It's a theory of population change. It's not a theory of absolutely everything.
Yeah.
So maybe that clarifies a little bit the direction I want to go.
Yeah, no, that's very, very helpful.
Yeah, that's perfect. I think there's Darwinism, evolutionism, and Christianity in six-day creationism or whatever, however you call that. Like the way people would frame the conversation is like they're opposed, right? Evolutionism is opposed to Christianity. And I love the historical analysis you make, because you said there was a competition for cultural power rather than a real conflict between science and religion, especially when Darwin came out, you know, with his writings. And it wasn't like a science versus theology, but it was actually scientists versus clergymen.
Yeah.
Could you comment on that a little bit?
Yeah, I've been quite persuaded, Octavio, by that particular kind of analysis. It really came from a historian, Frank Miller Turner, who wrote a really interesting article about this. And his argument was that before about the middle of the 19th century, you did not have at all a group in society known as scientists. The label is only invented in the late 1840s. So everyone's doing, if they're interested in this, are natural philosophers. There's no specialist group called scientists, and there certainly is no specialist group called biologists or geologists or astronomers or whatever. So from the middle of the 19th century, these disciplines begin to be professionalized. So now you could say to somebody, you know, what do you do for a living? They could say, I'm a geologist or I'm a botanist or whatever it might be. Now, this is a group, a cultural group, that are becoming a newly professionalized elite in British society in the second part of the 19th century. And they want to accrue to themselves certain forms of cultural power. And I'll give you a couple of illustrations of this in a second, if that's okay.
Yeah, that'd be great.
They want to accrue cultural power for themselves, but they're up against another group that already has enormous cultural power in British society in the middle of the 19th century, the clergy. Now, here are two examples from what Frank Miller Turner wrote about, very interesting. He wrote an article called, let me get the title of this right, Rainfall, Plagues, and the Prince of Wales was the title of his article. And what this was there were three crises that faced British society during the Darwinian era, if I can call it that. One was a series of summer droughts, no rainfall, not insufficient rainfall, that had an enormous impact on the harvest. The harvests were poor because there hadn't been sufficient rainfall. So that was a kind of crisis in the society, rainfall. Plagues. There was cattle plague, which obviously had a big impact in the agricultural markets and therefore had a huge impact on food supply and on the requirement for sustenance. And then the Prince of Wales, the young Prince of Wales contracted typhoid and was extremely ill for a period of time. Hmm. Now, here's the question. To resolve those problems, to whom should you turn? Well, the agricultural experts said, well, you should turn to us. We'll tell you how to deal with cattle plague. We'll tell you how to deal with managing poor harvests and so on. Maybe the economists. The medical people would say, well, you turn to us for solving health problems and so on. The clergy said, turn to God for a day of prayer. Now, which are you going to accept in the society? It's a struggle for who is society going to listen to.
Yeah.
Are they going to listen to the new professional elites who are going to try solve problems by expert knowledge? Or are you going to listen to the clergy and turn to prayer? Mm-hmm. Now, I guess when you think of it that way, this is not so much a struggle between science and theology. It's a struggle between clergy and scientists or scientific practitioners. And I suppose when you think about it, it's an interesting question. It's pretty clear which has won out in the history of our society.
Yeah.
I mean, Claire, when you get sick, do you lift your telephone and call your health provider? We call them general practitioners in Britain. I don't know what the phrase
they do.
Is.
Same here, GPs. Yep.
You know what a GP is. Actually, they didn't know that in the United States at all when I said that.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You turn to your GP immediately. Probably you might pray about it as well, but you probably don't have a day of fasting and prayer immediately. Now, I'm not thinking of that as necessary.
How secular of you, Claire?
Well, I'm going to say, is secularism the right word here? Or not. We might have to finesse that. But you can see how that's a different kind of struggle from saying, well, you know, Genesis 1 says this about creation, and that's what the evolutionist says. It's not at that level of science and theology. It's a struggle for cultural power. Now, let me say, in answer to your question, Octavio, that's only one way to think about the controversies surrounding evolution in the 19th century. There are other really interesting ways to think about it. That's not simply in terms of conflict at all. But I was interested in this one because it moves against the standard warfare model that science and theology are necessarily intellectually at one another's throats. It moves it into the social sphere, moves it into historical everyday practices more than on that sort of intellectual plane. So I think that's what I was after by using that in some of my writings.
Mm-hmm. And then kind of building on this whole idea of like, are we pitting these things against each other and sort of thinking those kinds of things, you would say to understand the encounter between science and religion, we'll have to give up trading in abstractions. So do you want to talk to us? What do you mean by that?
Yeah.
That, and the debates are locally and geographically situated, I think, yeah, is part of what you're talking about.
Yeah. Well, I've been very enthusiastic about that. You know, my motto has become always particularize, always particularize. So, you know, we hear these grand stories about there has been a warfare for hundreds of years between science and faith. Ever since Galileo was found guilty by the Catholic Church, it's been a struggle or a warfare and so on. And then you hear a different story which says, oh, really, since the time of the Puritans, Christians have been very enthusiastic about science and we wouldn't have modern science if it hadn't been for the Reformation and so on, a very sort of lovey-dovey cooperation story. And what I was inclined to do was to say, let's forget about those grand stories and let's just look at very particular debates in very particular places and see, did they all react the same way? So what I did was I took a group of Scots Presbyterians in five or six different cities around the world. And in all of these cities, there was, in the latter part of the 19th century, a great debate about Darwin. Now, think here, they're all reading the same book. It's called The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection. They all subscribe to the Westminster Confession of Faith. They're all Presbyterians. So if there's a grand story, you would think they must all react the same way. They're reading the same theology. They're reading the same scientific books. Surely, if it's a debate between theology and science, they're going to all say the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Guess what? No, they don't.
Oh, what a surprise.
Yeah. All Presbyterians.
You know, I don't know. Is this a Presbyterian problem? Is this a Darwinian problem? Who knows?
I don't know.
For example, when you look at my own city here, there was a very famous debate that took place in 1874 in Belfast. And without going into too much detail, Presbyterians were horrified. And they very much opposed John Tyndall, Herbert Spencer, Charles Darwin, and so on. They felt that this was completely going to undermine their society. Okay, you go a few miles across the Irish Sea to Edinburgh, and you look at a sister church, the Church of Scotland, and they have virtually no problem with Darwinism at all. What they're saying is that theology has nothing but the most kindly interest in the developments of evolutionary biology and things of that sort. And I ask myself, if they're reading the same theology, if they're committed to the same church family, let's call it Presbyterian, Scots Calvinism, whatever you like, if they're reading Charles Darwin, what is it that's making them respond differently to Charles Darwin? I then look at somewhere like the American South, and I find there a complete horror about Darwinism that's emanating from writers in the American South. And then I say, why? Whereas in parts of the United States in the North, and particularly in Canada, I don't find very much evidence at all of a struggle between Presbyterians and Darwinians. And what I try to do is say, look, these stories are embedded. They are embedded in particular cultural circumstances. And what's happening is that these feuds are giving expression to deeper cultural anxieties, but they're doing this through debates. That's to do with science, biology, and species transformation. So If you were to say to me about isms, I don't like this, what's the relationship between Darwinism and Calvinism? I'm going to say to you, it depends where you're looking.
Yeah.
If you say Darwinism and Calvinism in South Africa, that might be very different from Darwinism and Calvinism in New Zealand. That might be very different from Canada and so on. So always particularize. rather than trading in these grand, abstract sort of categories, I like to tell stories. And I like to tell them about particular places and particular events. And that's what I've been trying to do for a year or two. The trouble is, nobody's listening to me. But sure, it's fun anyway.
We're listening. We're, you can tell us stories. We'll totally listen.
So there are now two in the Western Hemisphere. That's great.
We got you back, David. We'll be your biggest fans.
Excellent.
Super sure. Yeah, I wanted you to address the confusion, historical confusion there's been with the title natural selection. It's off-putting for a lot of Christians because natural selection, okay, negates. Basically, people feel it's attacking God directly. It's like, you didn't do anything, it was just all natural. And you also quote Birx says that the name of the theory, like we're saying, is deceptive. So can you... help us understand, like, not just the historical confusion, but also what natural selection actually stands for instead of what, I mean, people think whatever they want, so.
Yeah, well, there are two parts to that question. I mean, one is, what really is natural selection as a theory with respect to evolutionary change? What does it say and what does it not say? And then there's the other thing about whether the label is a useful one or not. Now, let me start with the label one, first of all, before I get around to saying how I think the concept is very valuable. Right from the word go, you can see that natural selection is a metaphor. And it's a metaphor in this sense that what it really means is nature is selecting something. Now, right from the word go, when Darwin used this, critics say, well, the way you really portray this, can nature select anything at all? What simply happens is that some organisms that are better adapted to the environment survive. That's just the way it turns out. And they survive because they're better suited to the environment than their competitors. Fundamentally, that really means they survive and get the chance to reproduce. And some don't survive or don't get the chance to reproduce. And the ones that do reproduce, reproduce themselves. And if there's a variation, that variation is passed on to the next generation and so on. But nature isn't actively going around and sort of saying, look, hey, I'm going to select you, but I'm not going to select you. It's a metaphor. Now, whenever some of his critics said this, Charles Darwin admitted right off. He said, yeah, you're right. I only use this phrase. I think his phrase was, I only use the phrase natural selection. I think his words were, in a large and metaphorical sense. And that is to say, he doesn't think that nature, with a capital N, is a kind of agent doing anything. He just thinks that natural selection is a shorthand for describing this long process of adaptation to environment and survival and so on. But if you look at the rhetoric of Darwin himself in The Origin of Species, even though he says that he's using it in a large and metaphorical sense, he's forever slipping from the metaphor and having nature doing this, that, and the other. So he says at one point, natural selection is daily and hourly scrutinizing every variation throughout the world, accumulating all that is bad, rejecting all that is good, working for this, that, and the other. And of course, all of that is mere metaphor. It's a shorthand way of talking about these things. And he says, you know, nobody objects to speaking about gravitational attraction. Attraction is a metaphor and so on. Well, but when his critics read this, and this is where Birx is coming from, he thinks the name of the theory is deceptive because nature selects nothing. It is not an agent. It doesn't have the capability to think and say, right, I'm going to select this and I'm going to select that because I want to move in this direction or I want to move in that direction. But you can see how Darwin's language could indeed make people think that he had substituted nature for God. Previously, the thought was that God might have been doing some selecting, but now it has moved to nature. And a lot of people saw this as a kind of secularization of divine agency in the world by moving it on to nature. Now, can I say this has continued to be a debate right up to our own day. A few years ago, there was a very controversial book published by the now deceased but brilliant Jerry Fodor, who was a cognitive scientist. And he wrote a book and some articles in which he said that Darwin never was able to escape from the natural selection metaphor. Darwin fundamentally got the metaphor from studying one particular group of people, pigeon breeders. And he saw the pigeon breeder picking little chicks and saying, hey, I'm going to breed that one. And I'm going to breed that one with that one in order to get the results that he wanted. So, you know, from an ordinary rock pigeon, you can get in a very small number of generations, you can get fantails and pouters and jacobins. And these are so stunningly different pigeons that you would really think that they were different species. But you see what's happened. The breeder selected them in order to get the variety that the breeder wanted. And the question was, did Darwin ever really get the breeder out of natural selection? And Fodor thought that he really didn't. So I think that's where the confusion about nature selecting. Janet Brown beautifully wrote about this. Every time Darwin thought about natural selection, he thought of an English gentleman walking around the pigeon dovecot, picking the pigeons that he wants to do the breeding. But that's exactly what Darwin should not have been thinking if natural selection was merely a metaphor rather than anything else. Does that help at all with that issue?
Oh, yes, definitely. Definitely. Yeah. And I think the issue is still going on, because I especially when you hear agnostics talk and they know there's something out there that's doing something. And I've heard so many people call it the universe. So you have to trust the universe, like let go and the universe will take charge. Or you have to trust what the universe puts you through, or what the you were born that because the universe wanted you to be born there. So now they talk about the universe. So what I was reading that reminded me of, yeah, that thing is still going on, the universe selection.
Yeah, well, I think there's a lot of truth there. In that, because I think that if one was interested in looking at the history of scientific explanations and the kinds of scientific explanations that have come along, I think it would be very interesting to do two things. One is to look at the metaphors that people are using to express their scientific claims, whether it's the metaphor, for example, of nature as a, or of light as a wave or a particle or whatever. Metaphor seems really built into this. But I'd be particularly interested in those metaphors that are anthropomorphizing, that are giving agency to objects and so on, that in fact are unlikely to have the kind of agency that a human mind has. And you've got to then ask, what are the concepts that are being, as it were, smuggled into the naturalistic explanation that are trading on these anthropomorphic metaphors? So I think one of the criticisms that I am somewhat sympathetic to is the idea that nature can do this and nature can do that and so on. If indeed nature is as inert as physics has told us to be, short of developing a new metaphysics, which is going to be a huge task, then we've got to be very, very careful about smuggling in mind-related, purposive consciousness kinds of concepts into an arena where the scientists themselves would claim they aren't actually there at all. So I think there's a real trick about thinking properly about the use of metaphor. When you use a metaphor, you ought to be clear about where the analogies are, but also clear where the analogies aren't to use those metaphors really effectively. So I think I'm hearing you about the personification, the almost pantheicization of the universe. And if a person wants to be a pantheist, well then up front and say you are, and we'll have a debate about it, rather than smuggling it in and pretending that a secular universe is doing all these sorts of things.
That makes a lot of sense. I was going to say, is a metaphor better than a definition to you, David? I don't know.
Well, in one sense, I think that we have to acknowledge metaphors because they are inescapable. They can tie us down. They can lock us in. They can imprison us. And notice that I've deliberately used metaphors the whole way down there. They're locking us down. They are closing us in. They are putting us in prison. These are all metaphors to express a thought that I'm saying is that they restrict thought in some way. I think metaphor is inescapable. I think it's rich. But I think if we confuse it with literal speech, then we get into difficulties about confusing what we're really saying in the language.
Totally.
Sorry for interrupting your podcast, but Claire Perini has something really, really important that she wants to share with you.
For the last number of weeks and months, you will have had a little interruption from Octavio and I with me trying to say rgnt.net/give. And the reason for that is that we love hearing from people who are enjoying and appreciating the podcast. We love hearing that. And we love hearing that you enjoy it so much that you want to give Regent a little bit of a donation to say thanks. And so this is an invitation to continue doing that, or to do that for the first time, to allow us to continue to keep having these really good conversations with people all over the world about all sorts of things, about the good, beautiful kingdom of God and how it plays itself out in the life of everyday Christians. So if you would like to give a donation to Regent College to say thanks for the podcast, Octavio and I would be delighted. You can do that at rgnt.net/give.
And please, if you'd leave a donation, write in the comment box over there that the podcast sent you.
Enjoy the rest of our conversation. So natural selection is one of the terms we hear around Darwinism, and so is this, you know, survival of the fittest is one of those. If you don't know much about those are sort of words that are sort of around. You have talked about this idea of survival of the fittest has been sometimes used as a defense of colonialism or the perpetuating of racism. So can you talk to us a little bit about your sort of historic, your thinking and around that?
Yeah, I've thought a lot about that, Claire, mm-hmm. as a matter of fact. I think a couple of things to be said. The first one is that the survival of the fittest, first of all, was not Darwin's term at all originally.
Right.
It came from Herbert Spencer, and in some ways, it's not a good description of what Darwin had in mind.
Of what Darwin's saying. Mm.
The reason for that is that Darwin has no concept of the fittest. He only has a concept of the relatively fitter to an environment. So an organism survives not because it's perfectly adapted to its environment. It survives if it's just a little bit better adapted to its environment than its competitors. So he really should have referred to the survival of the fitter, if he really wanted to say anything at all.
Yeah.
Now,
yeah.
As for the race question, you must stop me in this because I'll keep talking forever about this.
That's
you know,
fine.
So you do
it.
Interrupt
good.
Me and so
yeah,
on.
Yeah.
So in one sense, and I'm going to give you two stories in a minute here. Before I get to those two stories, if you recall, which people often don't, the full title of The Origin of Species, you can see here where we're already almost by accident getting into this question. So the title of it is The Origin of Species by Means of Natural Selection or the Preservation, wait for it, of Favored Races in the Struggle for Life. Now, of course, Darwin was thinking about animal races or animal species and so on. But it's quite interesting that if you look at some of the early German translations of The Origin of Species, they have translated it, or at least one particular one translated it this way. On the origin of species by means of natural selection, or the preservation of perfected races in the struggle for life. Now, you don't need to think too far about the potential social uses of the notion of a more perfect race later on in the 20th century. So
yes.
Two stories. One of the places that Darwinism amongst the scientific community was most rapidly welcomed was in New Zealand. And this occurred about the 1870s. I think there was a Natural History Society, a Colonial Museum Natural History Society in Wellington. And one of the first discussions, not the first, one of the first discussions was by a man called Travers. Travers was actually from Ireland and was a politician, but also a natural historian. And he really introduced Darwin's theory of natural selection to his audience at the Colonial Museum. Right in the middle of this was a welcoming of Darwin because it showed how where two races were in struggle, were struggling with each other over territory, one had to survive, and it was right to survive, and the other would go to the wall. So this was absolutely a justification for settlers against Maori, against the Pakeha. In many ways, Darwinism was welcomed in New Zealand precisely because in its application to human races, in a struggle for existence, there would be the survival of the fitter. And he felt that this was just a law of nature. It wasn't something that we should lament over, or even worse, it wasn't something that people should try to stop or restrain. It was an inevitable law of nature, and humans had no option but to go along with it. Mm. Now, by contrast, in the American South, here we have people who could well have used this idea of struggle to justify the slave system, or at least the memory of the slave system. Remember, the book is published in 1859. The American Civil War begins in 1861. They're fighting over slavery. But of course, a lot of them are still remembering the good old days in the Old South and very much want to defend the Slavocracy. Now, you would have thought that adopting Darwinism would have helped that. Survival of the fittest, much like they were doing in New Zealand. But in fact, they didn't. They did not read survival and struggle out of Darwinism. What they read was human evolution, meaning that on one step backwards, blacks and whites, slaves and masters, were all brothers. They were all a united human family. And they wanted to hold on to this because they could justify slavery without turning to Darwin. And you know how they did this? They turned to Scripture. They wrote tracts and books with titles like The Christian Doctrine of Slavery. So when they read the New Testament and the Old Testament, they claimed they could not find a single verse in Scripture that condemned slavery, but that there were many metaphors of servanthood, being a love slave, and so on for Christ, that were actually beneficial metaphors for thinking about our relationship with God. So they felt that the Bible, if read literally, and if read tightly with respect to the language, provided enough justification for the slave system that they didn't need to turn to Darwin at all. So here are ironies. One place loves Darwin because it justifies racism. The other dislikes Darwin because it's not sufficiently racist, because they already have got a doctrine of slavery because they're getting it out of the Old Testament. So these stories are very complicated. If you go to Russia, the Russians hated the idea of struggle. They removed every element of struggle out of Darwinism, but they adopted evolutionary theory. Why? Because it fitted with their idea of little communes working together, supporting each other, engaging in what they called mutual aid. Supporting each other was a far better adaptationary mechanism than struggling against each other. So it's very interesting to look at these different national contexts in order to get a handle on what they're thinking about race, ethnicity, and the relevance of evolutionary theory to those debates. So I think you can't understand the circulation of Darwinism around the world without thinking about colonial societies, without thinking about the struggle for existence between races, the struggle for existence between languages, the struggle for existence between different forms of government, and so on. It's not that this is social Darwinism. It's that Darwinism always was social right from the start, because Darwin had turned to thinking about breeders, and also to the writings of the Reverend Thomas Malthus. It always was informed by social thinking. So it's not surprising that people would read social theories out of it. Now I've gone on for way too long.
No, but it just proved what you were saying at the beginning, David, about particulars. Actually, these things and these theories applied in different places with other cultural contexts, with other things that are going on. There has to be the particulars in order for us to understand things well. And so
I think that's absolutely right. And I think what's important there is that we try to understand the cultural circumstances within which these debates have taken place.
Right. Yeah.
So it's not as if they are abstracted from a particular environment or a particular cultural arena.
Mm-hmm.
They're embedded in the middle of these, and I don't think we'd properly understand the debates if we just intellectualize them onto a philosophical level. I think you've got to domesticate them much more into an environmental situation and a social one to make sense of the history.
Yeah, 100%. So helpful.
Oh, man. How cool was that?
Octavio's so happy. Look,
can, can you believe how good was that?
That's like, so good. Mic
I don't
drop.
Even want to answer another question. So, I mean, ask another question so people leave with that.
Yeah.
And how crazy good. I mean, when I was reading that, I was like, I didn't know there was such a crazy yet good connection between Darwinism and race and colonialism. Yeah, I had no idea how fascinating that was. Fascinating.
Well, I think another interesting set of points about this would be, I'd be interested in someone looking at this, the application of evolutionary thinking to understanding scripture. Now, I came across one or two cases of this, and sometimes people were regarded as heretical and so on. But one interesting set of thoughts about this was you cannot understand the trajectory of the development of Israel's theology in the Old Testament without understanding the social evolution that Israelite society underwent in the thousands of years.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to try to place texts within the context of the stage of society that Israelite society had achieved at particular points in time. Now, people have used that, of course, in a kind of skeptical direction, but others have used it in a way to try and clarify and bring out the meaning of texts in a way that might not have previously been available. And I think it would be very interesting for someone to actually do a project on evolutionary thinking in the development of, say, Old Testament theology.
Mm.
And you guys at Regent might be exactly the place to do that.
So
set off a student to do something
right.
like that.
Word for those who are listening, David Livingston's just thrown out a research topic there. So
there you
know,
go. There's a doctoral piece of work on the plate for you.
Exactly. David, as we end, you're a Christian. You care about these big ideas because you're a Christian. Why do you care? Why have you spent your life thinking about these things as a Christian, as a historian, with interest in like Darwinism and all of those things? Why does it matter to you?
Well, that's extremely interesting. And sometimes these things only become clear later on in life, you know. So I spent a lot of time being just really interested in intellectual history. I was very interested in trying to do apologetics and philosophy of religion earlier on in my life and so on. But I became interested in intellectual history, the history of thought forms, because I think that they have enormously influenced our modern society in ways that we are not even clear or know about. I mean, for an example of that is, you know, we've all heard about postmodernism and postmodern assaults on truth and so on. And that seemed to be just the preoccupation of ivory tower academics for a long time. And yet the word fake news is now on everybody's lips.
Mm.
And when you hear a truth claim, you're inclined to be skeptical and say, where's that coming from? Is someone trying to exercise power on this? So anyway, I became very interested in intellectual history. And I got sucked into this through reading a book by a Dutch historian of science, Roger Hoijkaas, Religion and the Rise of Modern Science, because I think I'd grown up with a kind of assumption that science was a kind of very chancy, not a particularly good thing for Christians to be engaged in. And the more I looked at this, the more I could find things in my own tradition that were much more positive, that were much more enthusiastic about the scientific enterprise than I had known about.
Mm.
And certainly I'd not been told about this in my own tradition. So in some ways, my excavation of all of this is a kind of autobiographical excavation into my own sort of archaeology and my own history. And I just think that I've become more passionate about this because I think that people need to be told more about their own histories.
Mm.
That includes the bad parts of it as much as the good parts of it. Because if we're not honest about the strengths and weaknesses of our own traditions, we'd never be able to mobilize them in the creative ways that I think we can in the 21st century.
Yeah.
So I think that's part of what I'm trying to do. And if you get into a huge debate between a creationist and an evolutionist and so on, and after 5 minutes you want to tear your hair out and think they're talking past each other and so on. But if you get a class and try to tell them something about the complexity of debates in 1870, they let you talk about it for a while without getting too angry.
Yeah.
Whereas if you plunge right into a contemporary debate, people take sides very quickly. Coming about these things historically, I think, can sometimes take the heat out of the passions that might be running. And then you can perhaps begin to see a little bit more clearly where we've gotten to.
Yeah.
And that reminds me about Alistair McGrath's book called Narrative Apologetics. I just finished reading that book yesterday because we're having Alistair McGrath on a podcast, I don't know, a couple of weeks from now. And it's basically what you're saying. The power of stories for apologetics instead of going, you know, debates and taking sides. And what you do is that you use historical narratives to do apologetics. It's amazing.
Well, when I did some teaching courses at Regent over the years, this is exactly the sort of route that Mark Nolan and I did a course on science and belief from the Copernicans to the creationist. And, I think that's just a way of more gently introducing people to the longer trajectories, to the stories, and also to giving these ideas something that's concrete in real lives, in real places, and what's been at stake, and so on. And so for me, that has proven, I think, to be intellectually more satisfying for me.
Yeah.
Whether it has been more enlightening for my hearers, I mean, is another question. But that's certainly the way I've tried to come about these debates.
Well, Octavio and I are only two of your listeners, and, you know, now two of your biggest fans who are going to read your other two stories that you write, but all the other three things you're talking about. But no, it definitely it's been very, very helpful to talk with you, David. And it is, I think, that whole idea of story makes me think as well, and kind of telling the good parts and the bad parts. That's exactly what Scripture does. Like, it's not a beautiful picture necessarily all the time, but that whole idea of looking at the particulars and seeing the whole story for all the good and the bad and the ugly.
Absolutely.
And then letting that form how we then go to live and think and be in the world is exactly what you're doing and exactly what we see happening in the story of Scripture as well. So it's beautiful. Thank you. Thanks for your time.
That sounds great. Well, look, it's been good to chat with both of you. Thank you for
a fascinating conversation.
Thank you for being so tolerant of this loquacious Irishman. I appreciate
the Bolivian and the Australian really enjoyed it. So thank you.
Yes.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for listening to the Regent College Podcast. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. To discover more about Regent College, its upcoming events, conferences, courses, and more content like this, visit rgnt.net. That is rgnt.net.